And now for something completely different.
This is the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Let's do it.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. With you till 3 on this Friday. We get jump-started into the weekend with plenty to do over the next few hours. Coming up, a lot of blowouts in the NBA playoffs, including one last night. I'll explain why. Plus, Nick Saban apologized yesterday. We'll break it down. As the war of words continues between Jimbo, Nick Saban, and now even Deion Sanders responded last night as well. We'll continue to talk about the big story in college football. Plus, Michael Rodak, who covers Alabama, will join us later on this hour to further discuss this Jerry Springer-like storyline in the SEC. We get ready for day two of the PGA Championship. Check in on Tiger. Quite the day yesterday for John Daly. What was the most impressive part of his performance? And an interesting thought revealed about Phil Mickelson and his issue. Which of the high-end college football coaches are under the most pressure this year? Could you miss the birth of a child for a sporting event? And a whole lot more throughout the afternoon. Whatever else comes up between now and 3. You can join the conversation throughout the afternoon, 843-721-9500 to give us a call. You can always text the show, 843-608-1734. Get to us on Twitter, at Morrow Middays, on Facebook, at ESPN Charleston, via email, studio, at kirkmanbroadcasting.com, or online at charlestonsportsradio.com. Head over there and click on our show page, where you can leave a comment for the show. You can find the latest versions of the show podcasted right there, or you can even take the Morrow Midday Show with you wherever you go by simply streaming us online at charlestonsportsradio.com. With you till 3, Trent's on the steel wheels. After quite the beatdown for the Heat last night, Trent, what's going on? How are you?
You know, Luke, positive vibes on this Friday, all right? I'm not hitting the panic button just yet. It was a bad game for the Heat, no doubt, but we'll get over it. You know, going into Boston does make me a little nervous for the next two games now that the series is tied at 1-1, but it's a positive feel-good Friday here on the Morrow Midday Show. I'm feeling good. The weekend's here. Glad to be with you. Kind sir.
Yeah, and summer seems to be here, too.
Oh, my goodness.
Already in the 90s these last couple days. In fact, I saw something online that it said like over 60% of the country is going to be in the 90s this weekend. So break out the Bananarama soundtrack. We're into summer here, at least for the time being. It is hot out there. Let me start with the Celtics and the Heat and what we saw last night. You know, the Celtics did their job on the road, splitting those two games. Now the Heat will have to do their job on the road, splitting in Boston. You can't fall behind 3-1, of course. I've enjoyed the NBA playoffs. I think they've been overall good series, and I think we get two good series here. I wouldn't be surprised if the Mavericks bounce back tonight, and I think Boston and Miami is heading. I thought both series would head towards six games, potentially seven. But what's interesting is while the series maybe have been good, a lot of the games have not. In fact, over the last 10 days, there have been 13 NBA playoff games. Eight of them have been decided by 25 points or more. Eight of the last 13 playoff games have been decided by 25 points or more. Some of the exceptions include Game 1 of Celtics Heat, where it was still a double-digit win. Maybe not a victory by 25 or more, but still by more than 10. In fact, the average margin of victory over these last 13 games is 23 points. So where is the drama, right? This is NBA playoff basketball. We've seen a couple of these games. Warriors-Grizzlies Game 1. You had the Bucks and the Celtics had a couple of games come down to the wire. But overall, a lot of blowouts. not a lot of intrigue within the game. Intrigue within the series, long series, going back and forth, teams erasing 3-2 deficits, but the games themselves have been blowouts. Now, why is that? I think it's pretty simple to figure out. You know, Major League Baseball, we have gone the way of analytics, where we know it's all about three outcomes. Walks, strikeouts, homers, that's all you care about. And while swinging for the fences with your launch angle, hoping for more home runs because that's the easiest way to score, a byproduct of that is higher strikeouts. We've gotten to the point now in baseball where you don't care about strikeouts. I mean, maybe you do as a fan. I don't like how many strikeouts there are. I still prefer a ground out to second base to advance the runner than a strikeout. Call me crazy. But when it comes to, like, the front offices, they don't care. Right, they don't care that, oh, this guy struck out 160 times. We can't pay him. No, because he also hit 35 homers. That's all you care about. Doesn't matter that Chris Davis would hit 200, lead the league in strikeouts. He'd also hit 40 home runs, give him a big-time deal. Strikeouts, that's just a side effect of modern baseball. And teams are looking, are willing to look past the strikeouts for the home run production. In basketball, the analytics have told us, right, that you need to shoot more threes. Because you only need to make, if you take 100 shots, you only need to make 34 threes to outscore 52s on those 100 shots. So while it's a lower percentage shot, you also don't need to make as many to score more points. But the side effect, the byproduct is that you're going to have off nights. Keep shooting. You're going to have the Rockets miss 27 straight threes. That's okay. Keep shooting. Because the analytics, the numbers tell you a three is still more valuable than a two. In fact, we don't need analytics. We know that. You need a first grade level of math to know that threes are worth more than twos. And especially if you're not shooting well and you fall behind, how do you try to get back in the game? By shooting yourself back into the game with threes. It's an easier way or a faster way to catch up. Right, you fall behind by 15, well, just keep shooting threes. They haven't fallen yet. They better start falling, and it'll be a way for us to get back into the game. So when you look at these playoff games, why do we get blowouts? Well, because the three-pointer is so inconsistent. It is still a low percentage shot, or at least the lowest percentage shot on the floor. Maybe it's higher now. Guys are typically shooting in the 40% range than, you know, a decade ago, but still, it's a lot lower than shooting around the rim. So you get off nights. You get hot nights, you get off nights. As the old expression goes, you don't live and die by the three-pointer. You only die by it. Maybe that's changed, but, you know, you live or you die by the three-pointer. Sometimes it leads you to a victory. Sometimes it leads to an early death, like last night. And you could be on both sides of it. Sometimes you're not shooting it well. Sometimes the other opponent is shooting it too well. And they both lead to the same results, blowouts and games that are put away early. So when you look at the Celtics, right, it's fairly simple to figure out why we've seen some blowouts involving Boston, or why maybe they've seen a little inconsistent at times. Starting with the Milwaukee series, because they swept the Nets, didn't struggle in that series. Remember, in game one, and I know numbers don't always work well over the radio, so bear with me, but in game one against Milwaukee, they took 50 threes and only made 18 and lost that game. Then they came back in game two, made 20 of 43 threes, almost half, won game two. Then they shot 27% game three and lost. Right? And then when they came back and the Celtics won that series against Milwaukee, when they lost Game 5, they were 10 of 31. Not good. When they won Game 6, 17 of 43. That is good. And in Game 7, with the season on the line, they shot over 40%, making 22 out of 55. Then they get into the Heat series. They struggle Game 1. Don't score very much in the second half. They lose. Well, they were 11 of 34 from beyond the arc. And last night, they were 20 for 40. I think they made 9 of their first 11 threes last night, set the tone, and really put away the Heat early on. The Dallas Mavericks are the same way. The Mavericks, like most teams in today's NBA, just go the way of the three-pointer. When Dallas beat Phoenix in Game 6 and 7 to come back in that series, they shot 41% from beyond the arc in Game 6, making 16 threes. When they won Game 7, they made 49% of their threes, 19 in total. But when they lost by 30 points in Game 5, getting embarrassed, well, they were only 8 for 32, 25%. And when they got embarrassed the other night against Golden State, they were 11 for 48, 22%. So why are we seeing these blowouts? Because teams rely so much on the three today, but the three is not consistent. You can't rely on it night in and night out. So it's as simple as when they shoot it well from beyond the arc, they're going to play well. We've seen that with the Celtics and the Mavs specifically, two teams that lead these playoff teams in made threes this postseason. When the Celtics are on, they're hard to beat. We've seen that through the last couple of rounds. And when they're not shooting it well from beyond the arc, it's hard for them to win. Same with the Dallas Mavericks. But the problem is you can't rely on shooting 45% from beyond the arc game after game, especially when you're on the road, as the Celtics were the first two games of this series with Miami. So while we get all these blowouts in the NBA playoffs, I don't know, maybe this is just the new way of the league. Maybe this is a side effect of the increase in analytics and the need to shoot so many threes. It's hard to shoot over 40% from beyond the arc game after game after game. It's still the lowest percentage shot on the floor. So you're going to have outcomes like the Celtics losing by double digits in game one because they couldn't make the three, and then coming back and shooting 50% from beyond the arc and winning by 25 on the road. And usually it goes to the extremes. Usually a team's just not consistently average from three-point range. They either have a really off night or they're really on fire. And it usually alternates. When they have one bad game, they're usually not going to shoot it. They're professionals. They're not going to shoot it that bad two games in a row. And vice versa. When you allow a team to shoot 50% from beyond the arc, they're probably not going to shoot it that well in the next game either. Leading to this roller coaster event where the series, right, teams keep alternating wins, losses, blowout versus blowout. How do they blow them out in this game and then get blown out in the next game? Simply just three-point shooting. It's inconsistent, just like the outcomes of these games, leading to these blowouts. Now, when you look at last night, Celtics-Heat, was that a case of the Celtics just playing better or the Heat playing worse? I think if you shoot 50% from beyond the arc, it's about the Celtics playing better. I think that was the big secret to the success last night. But here was Seth Greenberg and Tim Legler on ESPN's Get Up this morning answering that same question. Was this more about the Celtics playing better last night? By the way, also getting Marcus Smart and Al Horford back, that helps. Or was this about the Heat after a good game one win playing worse last night? Here's what they said this morning.
I think it was good Celtics. I mean, look, it's somewhere in between, but it is good Celtics. Celtics are a tough matchup right now. When the Celtics are healthy, and you've got Marcus Smart, an elite defender that could facilitate, takes pressure off of Tatum. When you have Al Horford, who could stretch the defense, and then you have a seven-man rotation where the pieces fit, along with Tatum and Jaylen Brown, who are matchup nightmares for the Heat. To me, it's more about the Celtics, and now that P.J. Tucker might be out, it's really about the Celtics.
That's key. And then, Legs, what did you make of how the Heat played in this game? I mean, they looked so good in that second half in game one. This was a different story.
Totally different story, and I think what it comes down to is that Miami could not guard them in the first half. And Boston came out laser-focused, very professional approach to how they came into this game. I love the fact that during that first game in the third quarter, I love that Ime Udoka called timeout, got in everybody's face as they were coming off the floor, because that told me he was going to also do that in the film session after the game because of how bad that was, that third quarter was in game one. And they respond to him. So he's able to get into them a little bit and challenge them. And you saw the response. So this was much more about Boston. Clearly, Miami has a couple guys that haven't played their best yet in Tyler Hero and Bam Adebayo, and they're going to need that. But this is more about Boston's versatility, their depth, their shot making, their defensive versatility. This was about the Celtics making a statement that they were not satisfied with losing game one when they felt they outplayed them for most of that game.
Yeah, it helps to get two starters back. It also helps to make 50% of your threes as well, including 9 of the first 11 for the Celtics. One of the bigger wins they've had in playoff history on the road. It was their largest halftime lead, I believe, in playoff history for quite that franchise, right, with a lot of playoff success. And for Miami, it was one of their worst playoff losses in franchise history, losing by 25, and really, it was worse than that. Now, heading to Boston, if you're Miami, right, same objective as what the Celtics just had to do. You got to split in Boston. But why are we seeing so many blowouts in the playoffs? Because we're so reliant on three-pointers, and that's still an inconsistent shot. When we come back, day two, it's the follow-up to Saban versus Jimbo Fisher. Nick Saban went on SiriusXM yesterday and apologized. Deion Sanders also responded. We'll get to all that when we come back. It's the More Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.
Spend lunch with Luke.
Attention campers, lunch has been canceled today due to lack of hustle. Deal with it.
On the Morrow Midday Show.
When I wake up in the morning, love, and the sunlight hurts my eyes, and something without warning, love, bears heavy on my mind. Then I look at you, and the world's all right with me. Just one look at you,
The battle between Saban and Jimbo lingers on. Deion Sanders now gets involved. And Nick Saban went on the radio yesterday to apologize to Jimbo and Deion Sanders. We'll get to all that coming up. Plus, Mike Rodak will join us in about 12 minutes from now. He covers Alabama. We'll get his insight as well in one of the big stories here of the offseason in college football. I love it. Love the drama. So, of course, we played the audio yesterday. We talked about it throughout the show yesterday. I'm sure you heard it by now. The original comments from Saban that started this whole thing. Jimbo came back with a flamethrower, just going after Nick Saban, what was really seemingly more of a personal attack. And we were waiting on Deion Sanders' response. I'll get to that coming up. Deion came out, and he gave his comments as well. But Saban went on to the radio yesterday. He went on the college football station on Sirius XM and followed up his comments and clarified his situation and apologized to Jimbo Fisher. Two clips from Saban yesterday. Here's the first one where he apologizes. I believe this is the clip in which he says, I shouldn't have singled out Texas A&M. Here's what Saban said yesterday.
You know, I should have never really singled anybody out. You know, that was a mistake, and I really apologize for that part of it. I reached out to him, never got a response, but I feel bad about it. But I'm not changing my philosophy on, you know, I look at the betterment of college football. What is good for the game? And sometimes those things are not what's best for Alabama, but I've been doing this for a long time, and you know, my whole focus has always been, you know, how can we help players be successful? And I don't want to take anything away from them, and I don't want to take any opportunities away from them. I just think systematically this is, you know, all the guys that are transferring, and, you know, I mean, it's a crazy world out there right now, and hopefully, you know, we can all get our heads together and, you know, make it so people can get back to focusing on what they need to do to develop while they're in college and get an education and become better people, become better players, have a chance to play at the next level, which is, you know, what we've always tried to create.
Saban yesterday. So apologizing for, you know, mentioning Jimbo and Texas A&M or Deion and Jackson State, but not sorry for the other things he said. He still believes what he believes about name, image, and likeness. And I tend to agree with Nick and his other points. I didn't know if he needed to, you know, I don't know if it was necessary to directly call out a competitor or another team. But I'll also say I'm the same person that always will tell you, right? Name names. If you're going to be broad or if you're going to be vague, like Jimbo yesterday kind of alluding to the things Saban has done. I don't know, maybe you should just come out and say it instead of trying to dance around such a subject or try to insinuate something without actually saying it. Right, and props to Saban for just coming out directly and saying who he's talking about or who he seems to have a problem with. I respect that. Maybe it wasn't the polite thing to do, but if you're going to go down that road, you might as well just call out who you're really talking about instead of trying to be vague enough where, you know, we can't directly tie you to a Jimbo or a Texas A&M where you keep that deniability. Oh, I didn't say anything about Jimbo. This case, Saban obviously did. I kind of appreciate that at the same time. But he apologized yesterday, didn't address Jimbo's dressing down of Nick yesterday. Here was the other clip from Saban yesterday in regards to talking about, well, his comments and how it's taken on a life of his own. This was the follow-up yesterday on Sirius XM.
I really wasn't saying that anybody did anything illegal in using name, image, and likeness. I didn't say that. That was something that was assumed by what I said, which is not really what I meant, nor was it what I said. So there's nothing illegal about doing this. It's the system that allows right. You to do it, and that's the issue that I have.
That was Saban yesterday. I think he's right. He never said they did anything illegal and didn't say, I don't think he ever used the word cheat. He just said buy players. Now, maybe we're getting into semantics here, and when you say that a team's buying players, we know what he means by that. But in Nick Saban's seven-minute filibuster on name, image, likeness the other day, and I've listened to it twice. If I remember correctly, he never said, like, they're cheating or schools are cheating. He just said it's something that name, image, likeness, right? You need a little some guidelines here. Can't be buying players. Now, again, maybe we're splitting hairs. Maybe that's the same thing, just a different way to say it. But that's why I thought Jimbo Fisher came out yesterday, called for a press conference, talked about cheating and brought up things about, you know, Nick saying something along the lines of they were breaking laws. I don't think Saban ever said that. Talked about, I got to sit up here and defend these. He's making personal attacks on the kids. I don't think it had anything to do with the kids. I think it was more about the coaches or the system or college football and the programs. Can you fault a kid that if someone's willing to pay you $1 million, right? Of course, 18 years old, maybe you come from a tough background, you'd love to take it. That's life-changing money for an 18-year-old, for even people older than 18. A lot of money, depending on how much these kids are getting. But I thought Jimbo Fisher, right, to go so personal at Saban, to bring up things or to assume certain things from Nick's words that he didn't necessarily say, as I said yesterday, I think it comes off as, like, very defensive. Almost like an admission, you know, you feel guilty about something. You're trying to defend yourself in such a strong way because maybe you do feel like you're hiding something. You ever have that buddy, right, that you're teasing? You're all teasing one another, and that buddy takes it too far? You're making innocent jokes, and then he gets really personal. It's like, oh, boy. You either touched a sore subject, or maybe he's just had enough. I don't know. Maybe Jimbo's just had enough. Lane Kiffin called him out on it. People were saying it on National Signing Day. It was supposed to be a big day for Texas A&M, number one recruiting class, and everyone was saying, yeah, well, you know, because you were paying kids. So I could get that. After all the hard work being put in, it was just trying to be ripped up. I can understand Jimbo's frustration. So maybe this is just, you know, pushing a guy into the corner. He's had enough. Now he's coming back swinging. He's heard Lane Kiffin. He's heard now Nick Saban. He's heard the media members and fans talking about it. He wants some respect. Or maybe, again, it's like that buddy that, you know, you touched a nerve. And even though you're just joking around, he didn't mean anything by it, now suddenly he gets real personal. It's like, whoa, hold on. Because Jimbo took that yesterday from like 0 to 60. Now, I thought Deion Sanders handled it better. Deion didn't hold a press conference. As I said on the show yesterday, right, if you're going to hold a press conference and spend 30 minutes burying the guy and taking personal attacks and, you know, throwing him under the bus as well, to me, that comes off as somebody that almost feels like they do have something to hide. Because if it didn't mean much, if it didn't strike a nerve to you, you kind of brush it off. You don't really care. And that's more what Deion did. Deion didn't say anything throughout the day yesterday. I mean, he sent out a few tweets, but nothing too serious. Didn't hold a press conference. Didn't do it on a huge national stage. He did an interview. And he said, in regards to Nick Saban, I still love him. I admire him. I respect him. He's the magna cum laude of college football, and that's what it's going to be because he's earned that. But he took a left when he should have stayed right. I'm sure he'll get back on course. I ain't tripping. Now, of course, remember, Saban and Deion do those Aflac commercials together. So a little surprised that Saban would go after somebody maybe in the conference and also somebody who he's worked with in commercials. But I think Deion also got the point because he said in this interview, Coach Saban wasn't talking to me. He wasn't talking to Jimbo Fisher. He was talking to his boosters. He was talking to his alumni. He was talking to his givers. He was trying to get more money. That's what he was doing. He was just using us to get to where he was trying to get to, which is what I said yesterday. See, Deion understands. He didn't take it personally. And Deion also said, no, we didn't pay Travis Hunter $1 million. So he probably feels like he doesn't have anything to hide. He's got no skeletons in his closet. He's not worried about what may come from these war of words. Whereas for Jimbo, to me, you call a 30-minute press conference the very next morning. You eviscerate the guy. You make it personal. You throw his reputation into the mix. You said he should have been smacked as a kid. Right, he said some strong words yesterday. I don't know. To me, that comes off as somebody who, you know, you touched a nerve because there's some truth there. And this isn't the first time we're hearing about Texas A&M, quote-unquote, buying these kids. And for Jimbo to say, like, I don't know what the collective is. I have no idea. Come on. These boosters, he also said later in the press conference, I never lie. I don't know. Right? Because these boosters are not going to be giving these kids money without the head coach, without his permission. You got to make sure you're recruiting these kids first and foremost. Like, is the coach actually interested in bringing these kids in? I imagine there's some sort of, it's all done in conjunction. Here is Matt Corral. He went on Fox Sports Radio yesterday. He played in the SEC, quarterback for Ole Miss. So here was his thoughts as somebody who was in the conference, played against these coaches on this whole situation. Here's what Corral said yesterday.
I think they all are the same. They all do it. I mean, every school does it, especially now with NIL being a thing. Everybody does it. You know, there's no school that, however they want to look at it, you know, at one way or another, this kid's getting benefits from whatever company represents that school or whatever alumni owns this company, and he gets to go to that school. And then, like, it happens everywhere. It's not, you know, and it's a thing in recruiting now, especially because of NIL. So, I mean, when I hear them go back and forth like that, it's just, I don't know. Me personally, it's like we all know why are they acting like they don't do it.
That was Corral yesterday. Yeah, that's the other thing with Jimbo, right? I don't think any coaches are at these big programs. I don't know if they should be throwing stones at anybody. I remember Steve Spurrier used to call Florida State a free shoes university. And I think that was before Jimbo was at Florida State, or maybe while he was offensive coordinator. I think it was before. But same idea, right? Like, none of these programs. He was talking about Bobby Bowden. You learn a lot of things from him. You don't learn anything from Nick Saban other than how not to do things. Jameis Winston had some issues. Helped him win a national championship at Florida State. Was always on the team, dealing with some legal stuff. You know, I don't think anybody has a clean closet in these top programs at the college football level. Here was Feinbaum again this morning on Get Up talking about the latest here with Saban and Jimbo.
Jimbo Fisher declared war against Nick Saban. He flat out went to DEFCON 1 and said, we're going nuclear. And, you know, we can talk about this in the parlance of laughter and jabs, but that's not what I heard from Jimbo Fisher. He looked at Nick Saban and said, you're a fraud. You're a liar. You may be a cheat. Let's peel back the curtain. I never wanted to work for you again. And for the record, Saban offered him the offensive coordinator's position when he went to Alabama. And talk to other people who have worked for Nick Saban. And what makes that so remarkable, Ryan, is that Nick Saban is sacrosanct. He's the greatest coach of all time, and his reputation off the field equals that. I have never heard anyone lay a glove on Nick Saban, and I've talked to people who have written books on Saban. Yeah, maybe he's surly. Maybe he berates coaches in private, but never anything like this in the public domain. This was simply one of the most extraordinary moments in recent college football history yesterday.
Yeah, guys like Saban are almost like untouchable, and Jimbo was finally the one that was willing to go take shots at his former boss, who those two evidently didn't have a great relationship before these last couple of days. We'll talk more about this coming up. I have more thoughts. Plus, Mike Rodak will join us when we come back. He covers Alabama. We'll get his insight as well. It's the More Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.
Spend lunch with Luke.
Attention campers, lunch has been canceled today due to lack of hustle. Deal with it.
On the Morrow Midday Show.
It's the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio as we continue to break down the story of the offseason between Jimbo and Nick Saban. Let's get right to it with someone who covers Alabama for Alabama.com. He's on Twitter at Mike Rodak. He's with us now. He's Mike Rodak. Mike, good afternoon. How are you?
Doing well. How are you?
Doing well. Appreciate the time. Obviously, this is the biggest story going on this week with the war of words between Saban and Jimbo. Saban then kind of apologized to Jimbo yesterday. Dion responded. Let me just begin, simply ask you, to you, what's been the most surprising part in all of this in terms of what somebody has said or what they've been willing to go out and say publicly? What has surprised you most about what has unfolded these last couple days?
It's funny. I don't know, and this may sound weird. A ton of it's not surprising to me. I feel like this is kind of what's been brewing behind the scenes. This is kind of what's been vague before, which I think has kind of become a little bit more explicit now. Like, coaches have been taking shots at each other all offseason. I mean, Jimbo did this back in February on signing day after Lane Kiffin had his whole thing about A&M and their, you know, they should get a luxury tax, and Saban had previous things that he was kind of coming after. Like, there's been shots back and forth, but coaches have kind of been, they've been very careful not to make very specific accusations and not to name specific schools and just kind of dance around it. And even, you know, Scott Satterfield from Louisville a couple weeks ago saying, you know, he thinks maybe Alabama tampered with one of their transfers, but didn't really say it explicitly. Like, guys are just kind of dancing around it. And then finally, Saban says something that's very direct. He says the words A&M bought their players. Like, those four words, like, that's what really made it explode. So that's, I guess, the most surprising thing to me is that he didn't stick with sort of what's been the mantra of let's be careful, but also let's try to call people out. He just went for it. And that's, I think, what kind of changed the game. But I think Jimbo's response was expected. Like, we all knew once they called that press conference, he was just going to go after Saban as he did before in February. And I think Dion's reaction is probably expected as well. Like, it's actually not terribly surprising for me. I think it's just been something that's been brewing over the course of several months.
I'll tell you, I was surprised that Jimbo seemed to almost go as far as he did. Like, he took a flamethrower yesterday to Saban. I'm surprised he was maybe took it as personally or was as personal towards Nick. I personally like Deion Sanders' response, where it wasn't a press conference, it was an interview. He seemed to be a little more maybe understanding, didn't make the personal attacks at Nick. So my question would be, seeing what Jimbo did yesterday, do you think that this was just a guy who's had enough between Lane Kiffin, the media, and now just it happens to be Nick Saban? Do you think Nick touched a nerve here, or did Jimbo just already was looking for a reason to go off on Nick? What do you think really went into Jimbo's, you know, war of words yesterday?
You know, I think there's probably that aspect of being associated with being Nick Saban's guy for so long. And they only worked together for 5 years. That was 20 years ago at this point at LSU, but he's always been known as the Saban assistant. And for a while, he was one of the Saban assistants who couldn't beat Nick Saban. Like, that was one of the questions he got every summer at SEC Media Days. And then finally last year, he called the shot. He said they were going to beat him, and then he did. And I think beating Nick Saban on the field probably emboldened him a little bit more just to fight that battle that, look, a lot of people are not willing to fight, like, on a lot of different levels, government, school, like, a lot of people are scared of Nick Saban. And I think Jimbo wants to be that guy, just from my perception of it, to not be afraid of Nick Saban and to kind of be his own man. And I think when you have your recruiting class, which is number one in the country, and yeah, I'm sure there was some level of NIL involvement there, but I'm sure there was also just good recruiting involved there. And I think he wanted to defend that and defend his own capabilities versus what Nick Saban was trying to tear it down to be something that's more monetarily based and not based on Jimbo and him building his program. So I think there was an offense taken there, which I'm sure coaches over the years have been offended at Nick Saban, but they haven't really said it publicly. I think Jimbo's kind of in the mode now where I'm not afraid of Nick Saban. I'm just going to go after him, and I'm going to break that ground that people haven't broken before.
Yeah, I mean, Saban always seemed almost like an untouchable. He was like a made man. Nobody would want to be willing to go after him as strongly as Jimbo did yesterday. Now, Nick, yesterday when he went on SiriusXM, took the high road in terms of he wasn't going to come back with personal shots at Jimbo and continue this. But I would imagine, or I'll ask you, you know, behind closed doors, how ticked off do you think Nick is with what Jimbo said yesterday, or is that something he could brush off?
Oh, I'm sure he is. I don't totally believe when he says, I apologize for saying, you know, A&M bought their players. I think he's just apologizing that it got out. And I'm not sure that it was entirely intended to get out. I mean, it was an event where, you know, yes, there were TV cameras plainly in view. There's reporters plainly in view. He surely recognized me. I'm sure he recognized other people that cover the team regularly. He sees at press conferences, and he still said it. But I think the original plan was for us to get kicked out earlier and for this answer to come at the end of this Q&A when we weren't there. And so I don't know if he ever really intended it to get out. So I think he's probably sorry about that part, but I would have to imagine if he said it, he believes it. Like, I don't think he truly misspoke when he said that he believes that A&M bought their players. So yeah, I'm sure that there's, you know, a lot of frustration, bad blood, whatever you want to put it, between Saban and Jimbo on Saban's part too, and just the way that Saban's wired. You know, I don't know if he wants to fight the battle as publicly as Jimbo is. I think he's probably more of the ilk of, you know, don't get mad, get even. And I think for him, getting even is probably going to happen on the field October 8th in Tuscaloosa.
What do you think at the end of that game, if we forecast months ahead? Do we get a handshake? Do we get a blow by? What do you think would happen when those two meet on the field in October?
I would guess some sort of a blow by. You know, I used to cover the Patriots, and there was always instances of Belichick and his former assistants. Remember Eric Mangini when he outed Belichick for Spygate, and then, you know, Belichick would just sort of give him almost like a look, you know, after the game, barely even touched each other. I don't know if Saban would go that far, but you know, it's almost like if Jimbo wins the game, I think Jimbo probably wants to walk up and shake his hand almost in, you know, a sarcastic sort of way. But, oh, yeah, that would be a huge story. We'll all be watching, you know, before the game with their binoculars to see from the press box, you know, what they do. Do they come and see each other on the field before the game? What happens after the game? It's going to be a crazy week, and it's, you know, still 4 months away at this point.
Yeah, yeah, it is. As we talk with Mike Rodak, who's been all over this story, covers Alabama. Do you think we get any fireworks at the SEC meetings coming up in just over a week? Do you think anything more comes from this specifically when we get these guys together at the SEC meetings?
I would say probably not in broad daylight. I would imagine that there's going to be a pretty strong effort from Sankey's part, which you've already seen. I don't know if you guys saw today where Lane Kiffin was supposed to be on the Dan Patrick show. and their producer tweeted that Lane Kiffin was told by the SEC he can't talk, as apparently other SEC coaches were told as well, that there's essentially a gag order in place. So I think there's going to be an effort on Greg Sankey's part to make this as least explosive as they possibly can from a public. And it's not like I actually haven't covered the SEC meetings yet. I've only been covering Alabama for 3 years. This is the first time they've actually happened. So I don't think there's really any organized media among coaches. So if they can avoid having to do any sort of media, I think they will. But behind the scenes, if there is back and forth between those coaches in the meetings, I'm sure that will trickle out and sort of get reported secondhand, as opposed to, you know, Saban or Fisher standing in front of a camera and continuing to kind of launch darts at each other.
I was going to ask you about the Greg Sankey thing with Lane today and the other coaches, because I don't know, maybe it's the old school wrestling fan in me. I love this. I think it's great to have this go on. Maybe Sankey, I could see how he could see it as maybe a little embarrassing for his conference. If you were in Greg Sankey's shoes, would you try to nip this in the bud, or do you kind of play up the drama? Because it could be, you know, this time of year, what else are we talking about in college football? Maybe this is an interesting storyline for the college football fans to get ready for the SEC season.
Yeah, I think there's a balance there, and I think he's savvy enough to understand both sides of it. You know, I think I read the Athletic story where there's some unnamed AD who said that the sport has never stooped lower, that it's never been as bad as this, which is probably true. But, I mean, I think Jerry Jones talked about it a couple weeks ago. Like, all PR is good PR. It doesn't matter if it's bad PR, it's good PR. Like, people are talking about you, there's interest, and I think – Sankey probably understands that as well. I mean, the ratings for this A&M Alabama game are going to be off the charts. Like, you know, people, like you said, are talking about it in the middle of May, when typically college football is not a story. So I think there's, you know, they're trying to play it both ways. And I think that probably played into the punishment yesterday, where it was sort of a public reprimand of, okay, we have to do this because that rule's in place, and I guess we have to enforce it. But it wasn't as if, like, they're actually truly punishing either one of them. It's just saying, hey, guys, like, stop it. But, you know, I don't think it's truly a deterrent for any of these guys to really stop talking.
A couple last moments with Mike Rodak, who covers Alabama for Alabama.com. In regards to – I should ask you this earlier, but for Saban, those comments the other night, was it him just like you said, you know, maybe he didn't think the media would be there at the time. Was he talking freely? Was that a message to the people in the room and his boosters? Was he intentionally just trying to take a jab at Jimbo? Was he trying to lead to changes? What do you think was the main reason of – what was Saban trying to accomplish originally with his comments?
I think there's probably a couple different threads there. I do think that there's probably some pent-up frustration on his part, which, like, he's talked – 5, 6, 7 times this offseason, I think, expressed a lot of those points before in frustration about where the current model is and all that. So I think that sort of the emotional component probably played into him saying that. But I do think, yes, he was talking to the room, because this was a room of, so, you know, World Games, which is like an Olympic-style event, are coming to Birmingham this summer, and there's these businesses that are sponsoring them. So these people got to come to this event and listen to Nick Saban sort of as a perk. But he understands, like, these people are CEOs of companies in Birmingham, et cetera, and these are eventually the people who are paying these NIL deals. This is where the money is. So I think he has an understanding of that. He sort of alluded to it in his answer. Nate Oakes, the Alabama basketball coach, gave an answer right before that where he essentially was campaigning for money from the room. So I do think there was an understanding of that. And look, I mean, it's – you have Houston, like, right outside of A&M, where you have tons of oil money, tons of big companies. You have Miami, where you have a billionaire like John Ruiz. There isn't quite that amount of money in Alabama, and that's going to hurt Alabama, the school, in trying to get NIL deals, just because the funding isn't quite to the level of what some of these other bigger cities might have.
Yes, certainly. Now, before we let you go, Mike, I know you used to cover the Buffalo Bills for ESPN. Now you cover Alabama. I've been to an Alabama game day. I haven't been to a Buffalo Bills game day. I know you're a media member, but when you go through the parking lots, when you're at the stadium, what's a wilder game day environment, Alabama or the Buffalo Bills?
Definitely the Bills. I mean, Alabama's like that SEC, like, you know, Ole Miss, you have, what, the chandeliers, and it's like very – everybody's dressed up, and it's a little bit more like – sort of that proper Southern church atmosphere. And Alabama, I think, still is mostly that way as well. Buffalo's just sloppy. Buffalo's like, people are wearing their Zubaz, like their sweatpants, and, you know, dizzy bad, and jumping through tables and burning things. And there's, you know, lewd acts going on. Like, it's anything and everything under the sun goes in Buffalo, where I think Alabama was a little bit more measured. But still, like, you know, they're fans. Like, they care just as much as in either city. I think Buffalo just kind of let it loose a little bit more.
Yeah, I could see that. He's Mike Rodak on Twitter at Mike Rodak, covers Alabama for AL.com. He's been all over this thing. Follow him on Twitter and keep up with all the latest. Mike, appreciate the time and the insight. Appreciate you joining us.
You got it. Yeah.
All right, Mike Rodak. He was there that night, as he said. I don't know if he was the one that put out the original video, but I think it was his tweet. If it wasn't his video, him, you know, kind of retweeting somebody of the video is really what, at least what I saw, and it really took off from the original comments from Nick that night. So Michael was right there in the middle of it. And here we are a couple days later where, for the meantime, you know, Saban took a little bit of the high road last night. Now Greg Sankey's trying to nip this whole thing in the bud, doesn't want any other coaches talking about it. And personally, I would probably be a terrible commissioner because I would play this up. I would love it. I think it's great. I mean, it's probably not great that you have two coaches in your conference going after each other, calling like one another cheaters. But it's May 20th. What else do you got going on in college football? And right now, we're all talking, oh, I can't wait for that game in October. We're looking forward to an SEC game where, by the way, last year Alabama was favored by 18. I think they'll be favored by a double-digit spread again this year. It's 5 months away, and we're already getting excited for it. I'd play into it. Now, again, that's probably why I would never be a commissioner. Greg Sankey knows better than me. But, yeah, he told his coaches he does not want them to do any media, any press, doesn't want them talking about it. He doesn't want this thing to get any worse. If I was Sankey, I would say, yeah, Lane, go on the Dan Patrick Show and cut a wrestling promo for us. Keep building this thing up. So by the time we get to October, it's like the biggest event of the year. We'll wrap up hour one. Some more thoughts on this when we come back. It's more Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
You never know when the day before is the day before. Prepare for tomorrow at ready.gov/today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Spend lunch with Luke.
Attention campers, lunch has been canceled today due to lack of hustle. Deal with it.
On the Morrow Midday Show.
All the new breeze feels so good. Can't help but remind me that it was a good day. Yeah. Not much to do but just stay around. Yeah, it was a good day. I'm so glad the sun stayed around. Yeah, it was a good day. Not much to do but just stay around.
It's the Morrow Midday Show at Luke Morrow on ESPN Radio. Appreciate the time. Last segment from Mike Rodak, who covers Alabama, talking more about the Saban-Jimbo drama this week. You can always get in touch with the show. Head over to charlestonsportsradio.com, click on our show page, and leave a comment for the show there. Dale said, ultimately, the situation between Saban and Fisher will spice up the upcoming football game between Bama and A&M. And more than likely, both schools and maybe even the SEC will reap the benefits from this. After all, people love drama. This is true. However, it feels like the legacy of both coaches have taken a hit from this. What do you think? I don't know if the legacy has. It's a good question. I mean, I don't think this does much for Nick Saban, unless we get some concrete sort of evidence that he's been doing some shady things, unless he's actually caught. Look, he's been a coach for a long time. We don't have anything on him that he truly did. There's rumors. There's speculation. There's some, you know, you see some guys driving around nice cars wondering, like, hey, how did that happen? But there's no concrete evidence or proof. And so for Saban, I mean, he's the greatest college football coach of all time. And there's nothing that ties him. He's smart. He knows what he's doing. There's nothing that ties him to anything that he shouldn't have done. So until Jimbo actually comes out with, like, some concrete evidence, hey, here's what happened, here's what he did, yada, 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 instead of just speculation or throwing stones, I don't know. Personally, this is just me. Maybe I'm biased in this whole thing. I thought Jimbo looked worse, coming out with the personal attacks. When he was backed in a corner. Maybe that was just me. All Nick said was he called out the schools for sure, but he didn't say anything that hasn't been said already about Texas A&M. And also, let's not act that whether it's now during name, image, and likeness or before NIL that this stuff wasn't going on. So what Nick said, like, I was surprised maybe he specifically went after a coach or a school, Jimbo and Dion. But I don't really disagree with anything he said. And then Jimbo came out and lit the world on fire yesterday, really going in, really laying into Nick. I'll tell you what, I think there could be a probably because there's more equity built up for Nick, I think there could be a bigger fallout for Jimbo because not only how harsh he was, But also, like, if you get trounced in October, or if you have another down year where you go 500 in the SEC again, I don't know. The more attention you bring to yourself or the more noise you make, the better you have to be. And Jimbo already has some pressure on him in A&M. Now he brings in the number one recruiting class. People are already looking to doubt him. I don't know if he'll affect either legacy. But maybe you look at the guys differently based off their comments this week. I don't. Hour two next.